Well, if you get a CD for this week's teaching, it will be entitled Dan and the Eclipse. I've extended the name of the teaching to Dan, the Shema, and the Eclipse. And this teaching kind of came about as we were the week before last in Israel, and we were driving south along the Golan Heights. We did a complete circle of the Sea of Galilee in one day. Started in Tiberias, went up north. Well, here, I'll show you a map. We started in Tiberias, which is right about there. And then we drove way up into the north to Mount Hermon, which is right up on the Lebanon border. And then we drove back down and we stopped at Dan, which I'll be talking about. That's the Dan in the title. And then we came down to the complete loop of the Sea of Galilee and back to our hotel. And while we were driving along the Golan Heights, the bits and pieces that became this teaching today came to mind. And so these are just thoughts from the things we saw and did. Dan is an interesting tribe. Dan's name means judge. And a Beit Din is a house of judgment, like a tribunal, and it would decide matters in ancient Israel and even today in Jewish communities. And on Jacob's deathbed, he prophesied over each of his sons. And when he came to Dan, he said, Dan Yadin, Dan will judge. That's what Dan means, to judge. Dan will judge his people as one of the tribes of Israel. Dan shall be a serpent in the way. And then a viper, a horned viper. This word for a horned snake is only found one time in the Bible, right here in Genesis 49. And it's some kind of a poisonous viper. A poisonous viper, a horned snake in the path that bites the horse's heel so that his rider falls backward. And then it says, for your Yeshua, I wait, Adonai. Your Yeshua Tega, your salvation. Now, I could ask the question, is this a prophecy that you'd want made about you? Is this good or is this bad? Well, the answer depends on who is the writer that falls backwards. Who is the writer? If the writer is an attacking enemy, then this is good. To make those enemies come and attack Israel, make them fall backwards so they do no harm to God's people. On the other hand, if the writer is your people, then this is a very bad thing. And Dan was poised to be one or the other, to fulfill this one way or to fulfill it the other. Looking at the map, you can see that Dan's territory is right down here. It's just due west of Jerusalem. Jerusalem's right there. Where do you need my glasses? Jerusalem is right about here. Okay? And it's just due west. Its territory abutted that of Benjamin, and Benjamin's territory is where the temple was. Dan's territory included the oldest seaport in the world, Joppa. That's where Jonah took off when he got swallowed up by the big fish. And the modern city of Haifa is right there. So it's a seaport town. It abuts the territory of Benjamin, close to Jerusalem. And this is a great piece of real estate. It's like a keystone right here in the middle of Israel. But Dan became discontent. They didn't quite conquer their land. And so they migrated and settled up in here instead. Dan moved. It seems that Moses foresaw this because, and I don't know how Moses got an extra S in his name, but it's Moses, not Moses. In Deuteronomy 33:22, this is what he prophesied when he prophesied over each of the tribes. He said of Dan, he said, Dan is a lion's whelp that leaps forth from the Bashan. Where is Bashan? Right there. He foresaw this all those years earlier and says they're going to spring forth from Bashan and they're going to attack. In other words, they go from their territory that was assigned in the book of Joshua and they move up here into the north. And Dan became the first tribe to be taken captive by the Babylonians. Dan was the first tribe to fall into idolatry. It was like the first domino that made all the rest fall over. And the reason is because they were discontent. They wanted a life of ease. They thought they had a better idea. Now, this is part of Tel Dan Nature Reserve. And this is a picture we took. Because at Dan, there's this massive spring. Water just comes gushing out of the earth. And this becomes one of the sources of the Jordan River. The other source is 2 miles directly east of this. It's a beautiful area. You're driving through an area that looks kind of like Arizona. It's kind of deserty looking. And then everything just turns green. Lush. Beautiful. Look at this. Look at all the children wading here in this naturally spring-fed pool. Wading and splashing and playing. And the remains of the city of Dan are still there. Massive walls and gates. The oldest clay brick arch in the world is still there and standing. And you can see the massive gates and the ruins of the gates in the city. It used to be called Laish, but Dan conquered it and expanded it into this great city. But Dan fell into idol worship. And this metal frame that you can see in the background is where the altar stood. They decided they didn't want to go to Jerusalem anymore, even though their original territory was right there, walking distance. They decided, no, everybody's going to stay put. We'll make our own altar. We'll worship God in our own way. And their way was the wrong way. This became a place of gross idolatry, gross immorality. That's Robin down there. Were you just getting ready to tell me not to take your picture? Oops, sorry about that. Now you go 2 miles due east, and you come to what's called Nachal Herman Nature Reserve. Nachal is a word for river. And there's another, right behind where I'm taking this picture, more springs, more wading pools, and just very green, very lush. It's also known as Banias or Banias, I'm not sure how it's pronounced, but in the New Testament it's called Caesarea Philippi. And what you see up here on this cliff are some natural caves, but you see all these little alcoves and platforms. And this is where the god Pan was worshipped. You know, he's a goat from the waist down, and he was a man from the waist up, except with horns. And this is where they would have their rites of spring. And you can't even begin and don't even try to imagine the sexual perversion that took place on these platforms and in the temples that stood here. Here's another picture of the same area. And you can see all the niches where they would have idols of Pan. Here's an artist's rendition of what this area looked like originally. You can see the natural cave back here. But there were buildings in front of these. And the Jewish people became very active in this kind of horrible, immoral, idolatrous practice. Yeshua went here. And you can find the account in Mark and in Matthew. I'm going to read Mark's account because he adds a little bit that Matthew didn't include. It says, Yeshua went out along with his disciples to the villages of Caesarea Philippi. And on the way, he questions his disciples, saying to them, who do people say that I am? Now, first of all, Yeshua, he ministered down in the Galilee. And then he would go to Jerusalem. But this time, he takes his trip way north, up to the very edge of the border of Israel. And Mount Hermon is right there. Mount Hermon's the tallest mountain in the Middle East. In fact, oftentimes you'll find snow at the top, even up into June. And the winter is a ski resort. People go skiing up there. And so he takes this hike. His disciples must have thought, why are we going so far north? Why are we going up here? And on the way, as he gets to this area, in the villages there, he begins to ask the disciples, who do people say that I am? They told him, saying, John the Baptist, who had just been killed. Others say Elijah, but others one of the prophets. And he continued by questioning them, but who do you say that I am? Peter answered and said to him, you are the Messiah. And he warned them to tell no one about him. And he began to teach them that the Son of Man must suffer many things and be rejected by the elders and the chief priests and the scribes and be killed and after 3 days rise again. Now you notice the part that's left out Matthew includes. When Peter says, you're the Messiah, the Son of the living God, Yeshua answers and says, blessed are you, Simon, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven. And he talks about giving him the keys of the kingdom and how the gates of hell will not prevail against it. Why did he say that? Well, in ancient Middle Eastern pagan practice, wherever water gushed out of the earth, that was a gate to hell. That was a gate to the underworld. And there's one at Tel Dan, and there's one here, just 2 miles due east. And these two come together to start the Jordan River. And so Yeshua goes here to the place considered to be the gates of hell and tells Peter and his disciples the gates of hell will not prevail against the truth that you've just spoken. But then Yeshua goes on in Mark's account. It says, but turning around and seeing his disciples, he rebuked Peter and said, get behind me, Satan. Because Peter says, oh, you'll never die. We're not going to let this happen. He rebuked him and said, get behind me, Satan. Isn't that something? For you are not setting your mind on God's interest, but man's. You know to be used to Satan, you don't have to be satanic. All you have to do is think like a person. Think according to human reasoning instead of God's. That's all you have to do. And so many believers who think of themselves as disciples of God run their lives according to their own human reason, which is exactly what Satan wanted Adam and Eve to do, and they did, and look at the mess we got ourselves in. This is what happens from following your heart instead of from following God's word. All you have to do is think naturally, and Satan's tickled to death with that. And then, but verse 34 is the kicker. Picture this scene. See all the people in this scene? Picture Yeshua standing here. Say he's standing right about there. And he summoned the crowd with his disciples and said to them, and I love the way Ray Vanderlaan describes this scene. He pictures Yeshua just shouting out to all these idol worshipers. And the disciples saying, shh, keep it down, keep it down. And he says, if anyone wishes to come after me, he must deny himself, take up his cross, and follow me. For whoever wishes to save his life will lose it. Whoever loses or lets go of his life for my sake and the gospel's will save it. For what does it profit a man to gain the whole world and forfeit his soul? For what will a man give in exchange for his soul? For whoever is ashamed of me and my words in this adulterous and sinful generation, the Son of Man will also be ashamed of when he comes in the glory of his Father with the holy angels. Picture him shouting this out to the crowds. And this is the area of Dan. This is where one of the tribes decided, I'm not real happy with what God gave me. I've got a better idea. It's real nice this time of year up north. And they move up to here. Right to the place where the so-called gates of hell are located. And they fall into this horrible immorality. They're taken captive by Babylon. Then even many years later, when Yeshua is born and comes, they're once again resuming their sinful practices. What was Dan's problem? They did not appreciate God's privileges. God says, Dan will judge his people. And the last of the judges, anybody know who the last of the judges is? He's the only judge who came from the tribe of Dan. When you read through the book of Judges, you come to the very last one. Who was it? Who was it? Samson. Samson's life is kind of a picture of like the tribe of Dan. And it ends in great destruction. His own and the destruction of those around him. He did not conquer his territory. Are you conquering your territory? You know what our natural inclination is as sheep when we don't like where we're at? Run away. Sheep are not thought of as conquerors, but God's given you a lion spirit as well. He's given you his spirit. And as we read earlier in 1 John 4, greater is he that's in you than he that is in the world. You've overcome the world. But we just want to go around, You have a new nature. Yeshua is a lion and a lamb. That means you are too. Learn how to be a lamb when you need to be a lamb. Learn how to be a lion when you need to be a lion. Conquer your territory. Where are you at? What's the thing right now you want to give up on? That's the area you need to conquer. Because you don't want to wind up like Dan. He was dissatisfied with his lot. You dissatisfied with yours? Wish God made me more better looking? Wish he made me smarter, more talented, more capable of a high paying job? I wish he'd give me different parents. Wish he'd give me different kids. Different spouse. Dissatisfied with your lot? Don't be like Dan. Conquer your territory. And he desired comfort and ease. I'm just tired. I just want to give up. Don't grow weary in well-doing. That's a commandment. Do not grow weary in well-doing. And you know what? When you choose not to grow weary in well-doing, guess what? You're not weary anymore. What you really turn out being weary, what you think is making you weary isn't. What's making you weary is your complaining. Because God's not giving you grace for that. What makes you weary is your dissatisfaction. God doesn't give you grace for that. And you blame it on the good works you're doing. No, they're not. It's your complaining, your selfishness, self-centeredness. That is what's wearing you down. So let it go. Get rid of it. Quit feeling sorry for yourself. I picked up a book when I was in Israel. It's called The Shema. It's by Rabbi Avraham Trugman. I've only read about 25 pages, but that was enough. My brain was getting full. And he brings out something that Rabbi Yisroel ben Eliezer, better known as the Baal Shem Tov, who lived from 1698 to 1760. He says, the Baal Shem Tov says that there are three phases of every human endeavor. Now, think of that. Every human endeavor. I don't care what it is. I don't care whether it's you trying to succeed in your business, succeed in your marriage, succeed at learning how to play an instrument, succeeding in sports, succeeding, you fill in the blank, or succeeding in getting the people of Israel out of Egypt and into Canaan. It makes no difference. Three stages, and I've thought about this, and I agree with him. There are three stages. The first stage is submission. First of all, seeing the goal, deciding that is worth pursuing, and submitting your energies to that particular thing. Little boys, little girls want to give their energies all kinds of things. I want to be an astronaut, a sports star, a multimillionaire, a rock star, and I want to be president. Nah, I don't want to be president. I want to be this and that. And they want to do all these things, but as they mature, they have to pick one thing and then pursue that one thing. And they submit their energies to that one thing. But after that comes the separation. I call this the wilderness period. Because during the separation, this is a time when all the stuff that doesn't matter has to fall away. Stuff has to die. You have to let go of everything else. And also, even the joy and the drive and the pride and the vigor you had in pursuing that might really diminish. You may not feel like, is this really worth it anymore? And you feel like you're just trudging along. But if you stick with it, you see it to the end, then and only then do you come to what's called the sweetening. And you look back and you think, it was all worth it. I'm so glad I didn't give up. And you begin to enjoy the fruit of what you've invested in. But there's no way to get from 1 to 3 without going through the wilderness, without going through this. Now, you can't shorten this period of time, but you sure can make it longer. Deuteronomy says it was only, what, 11-day journey from Mount Sinai to the Jordan River to Canaan. And they managed to stretch that 11 days into 40 years. And if you're in the wilderness a lot longer than you think you should be, you're the one who made it longer. God didn't. And just simply means the wilderness isn't done with you yet. And you heard me right. The wilderness is not done with you yet. It still has things in you it needs to purify. There are things in you still need to die and fall off. There's still a lot of ego there that maybe needs to be amputated away and let go of. And Tregman brings out something brilliant. He says, you know, the Shema. We say the Shema every, you know, I say it in the morning. I say it before I go to bed. And we say it in our prayers. Shema Yisrael Adonai Eloheinu Adonai Echad. 6 words. And he says these 6 words portray these 3 areas. Let's look at the first 2 words. The first 2 words are Shema Yisrael. Hear. And you know, to hear means to obey. It means to submit. To truly hear. You know, when Moses in Exodus 24, he takes the book of the commandments that God has given him at that point. He reads it in the ears of the people and said, everything God has said we will do and we will hear. We're going to obey them. This is the submission. Hear, O Israel. This is when we decide, I'm going to follow him. I'm going to hear what God has to say, not follow what my eyes see. I'm going to follow, because faith comes from hearing. Remember, spiritual light comes through the ears, not through the eyes. I'm going to go by what I hear in the word of God because I know it's true. Everything around me speaks one message. And this is why we cover our eyes. We say the Shema, blocking out everything in the world so we can hear clearly. Hear, O Israel. God's calling you to follow him. We're saying yes. We're going to submit to him. But then the next 2 words are Adonai, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, Eloheinu. It takes 2 words to translate Eloheinu. It means our Elohim. Now, what is it about Adonai, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, and Elohim? Why? What's the dynamic of these two names? When you see God's four-letter tetragrammaton, Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, what does that indicate? It represents his characteristic of what? Mercy, grace, gentleness, loving kindness. When you see that word used, God has presented himself in this aspect of his character. But when you see the word Elohim, and that's these first 3 letters here, the new at the end means our. So instead of Eloheinu, they just shorten it, Eloheinu. When you see Elohim, that is representing God and his characteristic of what? Strict justice. Justice. So the middle 2 words are Adonai Eloheinu. It's like all of a sudden we see 2 aspects of God. Yeah, we know he's merciful and kind, but man, this way is hard. And it seems like there's so much discipline he brings into my life. Because he's a good father. And like Hebrews, was it 12, talks about? Every good father disciplines, musar, brings musar, discipline into his son's life. And it's never pleasant, it says. But if we're trained by it, we'll enjoy what? The peaceable fruit. Fruit is sweet. The peaceable fruit of righteousness. And the last 2 words, Adonai Echad. Adonai is one. We realize that Adonai and Elohim, they're one. And it all proceeded from mercy, loving kindness, gentleness, from grace. You see, Adonai is used 2 times. Elohim is only used once. Because God's overarching character is of love and of mercy and grace. But inside that, there's a core of steel. And he will discipline. He'll chasten every son he loves. That's what he does. Because he wouldn't be a God of love if he didn't. To be Yod-Heh-Vav-Heh, he has to be an Elohim. And if you're going to be a parent who truly loves their kids, you have to be a disciplinarian. You have to be. If you're not, guess what? You don't love your kids. You love your feelings about your children. So there's a sweetening when everything becomes one. And the rabbis talk about the Shema, and they say, when we say God is one, we're not just saying there's just one God. We all know that. But when they say Adonai Echad, they mean he's the one and only with whom the world has to do. He is the one in whom the entire world lives and moves and has its being. That he is the one who controls the world and everything in it. He's the one who runs the world, and someday the entire world will know it. Look at Zephaniah 3:9. I put this, I like the ESV and I like the New American Standard as well, so I put both here. It says, for at that time I will change the speech of the peoples. You can also put the word language of the peoples. I will change the language of the peoples to a pure language. Maybe this is a prophecy that one day we'll all be speaking Hebrew. I want to get a jump start on that. You know, Paul says, though I speak with the tongue of men and of angels, English, German, Chinese, whatever you speak, that's the tongue of men. Hebrew is the tongue of angels. But anyways, I digress. It says that all of them may call upon the name of Adonai and serve him with one accord. What the Hebrew says, they may serve him with shechem echad, one shoulder, or shoulder to shoulder. Can you imagine such a day when everyone in the world, because it says the peoples, this is plural here, peoples, the peoples, right? The Gentiles. We all serve God shoulder to shoulder? Can you imagine? It's coming. It is coming. So won't we set an example of what it's going to look like? You know, this is what we're supposed to be doing. Zechariah 14:9. And Adonai will be king over all the earth, and that day Adonai will be one, and his name one. Echad. One more, Isaiah 11:9. They will not hurt or destroy in all my holy mountain, for the earth will be full of the knowledge of Adonai as the waters cover the sea. The best is yet to come. Don't ever talk about the good old days, but the good days to come. This is what is our destiny. We need to live in light of this truth. If you believe this, it changes the way you live now. We want to model this now, right? The sweetening is coming. Right now, things feel like death and destruction and separation and chaos. But this is where we are refined. This is where we go through this time of separation. You know, think about it for a second. God gave the Torah to Moses, right? He gave the Torah to Moses at Mount Sinai. And the first letter of the Torah is the letter Beit. The first letter of Bereshit, in the beginning. Bereshit bara Elohim et ha-shamayim ve-ha-aretz. In the beginning, God created the heavens and the earth. But the letter Beit kind of looks like a number two. That's because it's the second letter of the alphabet, and it has a value, a numerical value of two. Before this, everything was one. But now God says, I'm introducing two now. You've got the physical and the way the world's been doing things, a sinful world. From Adam and Eve up to the present. But now there's two. Now there's a second way. There's a new way to live. And it begins within the beginning. God created the heavens and the earth. He's in control. He's the one. He's in charge. And here's my Torah. This is how you live as a human being. This is my guidebook, my handbook for being a human being. More specifically, for being a disciple of the Master. There's a second way to live. Dan didn't learn that. Dan just followed their own inclinations, their own way. And they fell right into a satanic, idolatrous, immoral way of living, and they were destroyed. You know, when you go to Revelation chapter 7, it lists 12 tribes. You'll notice there's one name omitted. Dan's not there. When you get on the eclipse, we've talked about Dan. We've talked about the Shema. Let's talk about the eclipse. Now, any of you who know science at all and how eclipses work, you know that an eclipse, a solar eclipse, only takes place when there's no moon. Another, what I mean is the moon's there, but the dark side, the back side of the moon is facing the sun. It's getting all the light, and so we don't see any moon at all. And the next day after a solar eclipse is always a new moon, which means it's a new month. Because in the biblical calendar, a new month always begins with a new moon. All right? And by the way, before people make a lot of big deals about solar eclipses, I just have news for you. They take place every 6 months. Okay? They're not rare events. Every 6 months, there is a complete total solar eclipse. It's just that since most of the globe is covered with ocean water, it's out in the ocean somewhere. Or some little island, you know, or something like that. And there's nobody there to see it. This last eclipse was unique because it went across the entire continental United States, which is very, very unique. But don't think that eclipses are a big deal. They're still God's signs in some way. But they're not rare, okay? They happen twice a year. And so this solar eclipse that we made so much of began the month of Elul. We are in the month of Elul. And Elul is a unique month. There are no holy days, traditional or biblical, in this month. I guess you can call it kind of a boring month. There's nothing happening in Elul. And yet, the sages have said that Elul is the month of the bride. It's a month that the bride makes herself ready. They say also it's the month that the king goes out to the field. You see, when there were kings, if you wanted to talk to the king, you had to go through all the bureaucracy, fill out the forms, make sure you had a good reason, then schedule it in the calendar, then you waited and waited, and you had to get yourself all dressed and learn how you come to the king and what you have to do and how you bow and everything else. And then finally the day comes, you get your 15 seconds to talk to the king. The rest of the time you spend out in the field working. But once in a while, the king himself leaves the palace and goes out into the field. And when he does, he greets everybody. No appointments necessary. And he smiles on everyone and greets them. How are your crops this year? How are things going? And he would talk to you just like you talk to one another. Yet this is the king in the field. They say Elul is the month where the king goes out into the field. Now, in Song of Solomon, verse 216 and verse 63 are very similar. Verse 216 says this, Dodi li va'ani lo. My beloved is mine. That's what the word li means, to me. And I am his. Lo means his, to him. Li means to me, lo means to him. Dodi li. My beloved is mine, va'ani, and I, lo, I'm to him. But over in chapter 6, verse 3, it reverses it. It says, ani ladodi, vadodi li. I am to my beloved, I'm as my beloved's, I belong to him, and he belongs to me. See the reversal? What's going on here? Rabbi Schneerson has a brilliant insight to this. He says, you know, the whole book of the Song of Solomon is a love conversation between a bride and the bridegroom, the wife and her husband. And the bride is narrating, for the most part, the entire book of the Song of Solomon. And he said that in every marriage, there are times where intimacy is introduced by the husband. And other times where the intimacy is initiated by the bride. And all of this is a picture of God and his bride, picture of God and his and us, the believing community. And generally, it's the husband who initiates the intimacy. Generally, God is the one who initiates the love between him and us. We love God not because what? He first loved us. He initiated it. He's the one who sent his son to earth. He's the one who initiated our redemption, our salvation. His love for us long preceded our love for him. Right? So, my beloved is mine. Oh, he's given himself to me. You know what? I'm his. I'm responding. But in 6:3, it's reversed. I am my beloved's. I'm giving myself to him. And my beloved is mine. And he's responding to me. The month of Elul is where this takes place. Because you see, if you take the first letter of these four words, Aleph, Lamed, Vav, Lamed, what does it spell? Elul. This is something Dan knew nothing of. They thought God was there to get from. And they didn't like what they got from God. So they went to improve their lot and they fell into a horrible sin. What a dumb idea it turned out to be. But to initiate and to be the one, when God seems to be far away, when things just seem really still, things that go one way or the other, and that we initiate without any spark from him, without any commandment from him, we just cry out to him, God, I love you so much. And the sages teach that when the bride initiates intimacy, it's always a stronger intimacy than when the husband does. It's always richer and deeper. And this is the month of the bride. It's almost like God standing back. Which way are you going to go? I'm just waiting on you. What are you going to do? So I want to finish with this. Elul started with an eclipse. And oh my goodness, how many millions of people turned out and traveled to be right there and to get their black glasses on and watch this event. And my cousin in Tennessee, he emailed me. And Joe, he listens to the teachings and we communicate. Great guy. And the center of the eclipse there in Cross Plains, Tennessee, just was about a 5-minute drive from him. So, I mean, they saw the full eclipse right there on the farm, just watching this. He says it was really something to see. It was amazing. We saw about 80% eclipse here in Akron, but there they saw it 100%. So Elul, this month of Elul, started with the sun being blotted out by the moon. But what does Elul end with? A new month, Tishrei. And what do we do when the sun goes down and the new moon first appears? We hear the sound of the shofar being blown. This is something physical that the whole world is paying attention to. Everybody's going out to see this thing. How many people are paying attention? Going indoors or wherever, to the synagogue, to the meeting place, so they can hear an old smelly horn being blown. But where does spiritual light come in? The eyes? People turned out to see darkness. Think about that. And yet we're going to come together in Rosh Hashanah to be awoken to spiritual light. This insignificant seeming event. But I want you to think about a horn for a second. I'm not even going to try to draw a head, but let's say this comes off a ram. This is where the ram's head is, right? This is the working end of the horn. This is the point. And they cut that off. And so if you see a ram coming at you with a horn, you know to get out of the way. Because it's coming there to bring destruction. But what happens when you take that same horn, you take it off the head, and this time you blow air out of it? This becomes the working end of the horn. But instead of in the physical world, it's in the spiritual. And it's coming there to bring destruction. I'll be right up front with you. Rosh Hashanah comes to bring destruction. To bring destruction to all those things that have lulled you to sleep. All those things have distracted you from what you're here on earth to do. All the things that kind of want to seduce you away from who you are. And just kind of blow them away. Just shake them down like the walls of Jericho came down when they blew the shofars and they blew the trumpets. Just bring it crashing down. And just start a brand new start. A brand new start. Like waking up and think, oh, I dozed off. Oh, I never remember what I'm supposed to be doing. That's what Rosh Hashanah is about. Let's make sure we show up for this. Let's make sure we prepare our hearts over the rest of this month of Elul. Cry out to God, initiate with Him the kind of fellowship you really want with Him. Maybe a fellowship you've never had with Him. Maybe you've been kind of a cold bride to the bridegroom. Maybe it's time for you to warm things up, to initiate. That's His forgiveness. To cry out to Him and say, I love you. I didn't know if I was going to share this. I haven't even shared this with Robin, but I was just getting really tired. Not physically. I wasn't getting grumpy and perturbed or anything. I was just tired. Spiritually, just kind of exhausted. And so on the plane to Israel, I just asked God to revive my soul, to restore my soul. Because that's what He does. He's a good shepherd. He restores our souls. Mine needed restored. I wanted the joy of my salvation to be renewed. Just tired. No moral failings, at least nothing big that I can think of. I mean, it wasn't like I was crashing and burning. Just needed my soul restored. And so we arrived in Tel Aviv and met our dear friends, Neil and Sandra from South Africa, and spent our trip with them. We're godly people, wonderful people. And you'll get to meet them. They're listening. Neil and Sandra, you're coming to Ohio, okay? You told us you're coming, so we're counting the days. And so we traveled with them. Wonderful, wonderful time with dear friends. And then by the time we got up to the north and started driving south, God began to restore my soul. Can't think of any one specific thing, but just a bunch of little things that happened. It's like breathing new life into me. And I just want to take the rest of this month of Elul just to tell Him how much I love Him. I invite you to do the same. By the way, when we got to Jerusalem, our dear friends Gary and Lynn Preston from London were there. So we had three continents all together there celebrating Shabbat last Shabbat. And you've all met Gary and Lynn. They've been here with us, and Gary's taught. He just taught at Shavuot this past summer. And what an incredible time. And it seemed like, when I came back, it's just like, I'm ready to go. And so if you need your soul restored, ask God to do it. You don't have to go to Israel. It just happened to be where God restored mine. But I think a lot of times we just get tired. We just do. It's what happens. So if you are, take this time, these high holy days, this opportunity comes once a year as a time to ask Him to restore your soul. Tell Him how much you love Him. Give yourself to Him anew. and shake off the dust, pull yourself up out of the mud, and begin to walk again. And the commitment you made to him so long ago, renew your vows to the lover of your soul. Okay? Let's close in prayer. Our Father and King, thank you so much for you're such a good God to us, more than we could possibly imagine or even hope. But the older I get, the more I get little glimpses of just how great your love is. So, Father, I pray that all of us in these last days, which may be the last remaining months before Messiah comes back to establish his kingdom, I just pray, Father, that if we are alive for that event, that when he comes, he'll find us strong and faithful. But Lord, we do love you. Help us to love you more. Help us to love you the way you deserve. Not to love you even for what you've done or for what you're doing, but just loving you because of who you are, just because we love you. So that our love to you is a gift that comes from a heart that's just full. May our affections be aroused for our Creator and Redeemer, so that we can be a bride without spot, without wrinkle, be pure in all of our motives toward you and towards one another. Make us the people you want us to be, Father. We ask in Yeshua's precious name. Amen.